Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Karen Lee of the Friends Committee on National Legislation, who assesses the current crisis on the Korean Peninsula and growing hostility toward the U.S. from the people of South Korea. Playwright, feminist, and anti-violence activist Eve Ensler, who reads her essay titled V-World, What It Looks Like When Violence Against Women Has Ended. And Jerome Berrigan, who talks about his late brother Philip Berrigan and his lifelong commitment to the peace movement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Cheers rang out in late December as dozens of peace monitors arrived in the disputed territory of Aceh, where for 26 years, Muslim rebels have been fighting against Indonesian soldiers. Indonesia has agreed to grant the region significant autonomy over its affairs, including most of the revenue from the area's rich oil and natural gas reserves. According to the BBC, the first step is enforcing a ceasefire and ensuring that the rebels and government troops withdraw to agreed-upon zones. The plan calls for balloting in 2004 to elect a new autonomous provincial government operating under Islamic law. Known locally as the Free Aceh Movement, rebels have not given up on their dream of full independence, which is strongly opposed by the Indonesian president, Megawati Sukarno-Putri. Aceh's future could be bright if the province could benefit from its proximity to the Malacca Straits, one of the world's busiest transit hubs and access point for oil moving to Europe and the United States. But first, the ceasefire must hold, which depends on the operation of the Joint Security Committee, made up of rebels, Indonesian army commanders, and peace monitors. The biotech industry is working on a new pet project. It's moving ahead on research that injects drugs and industrial chemicals into plants, in essence turning cropland into giant biological factories. Pharmaceutical companies say that through this research, new drugs could be brought to market at much lower prices. The drugs could be incorporated into foods like tomatoes and other fruits and vegetables that are eaten raw. So far, the new pharma drugs are only in the experimental stage. Through the mid-1990s, the U.S. Department of Agriculture allowed over 200 field tests of drug and chemical-laced crops, mostly using corn. Critics warn that these new biotech crops could contaminate the U.S. food supply with unknown substances. In mid-November, these fears were borne out when 500,000 bushels of soybeans in Nebraska were quarantined by the government because corn used to make a pharmaceutical drug was mixed in with the soybeans. The Union of Concerned Scientists Jane Rasier said, "This incident illustrates the vulnerability of the U.S. food system as pharma crop technology has outpaced the government's ability to control risks." She added that the government must establish a strong, transparent regulatory system based on input from the public and the scientific community. Until that happens, food safety groups want the USDA to impose a one-year moratorium on field tests and commercial production of the new pharma crops. In its heyday during the late 1970s and early 1980s, the punk rock band The Clash fused high-energy guitar mixed with third-world rhythms, laced with a radical political message rarely heard on mainstream radio. Joe Strummer, the leading force behind The Clash, sometimes dubbed the only band that matters, died on December 22nd of a heart attack in England. He was 50 years old. At the time of his death, Strummer was working with U2's Bono and Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics on a new song, 48864, the number worn by Nelson Mandela as a political prisoner in South Africa's Robben Island. The song was set to debut in early February as part of a benefit to fight AIDS in Africa. The Clash mixed their hard-edged leftist politics with reggae, ska, funk, and African rhythms. Clash songs blasted away at Margaret Thatcher's England and the foreign policy adventures of the Reagan years. Strummer was born John Graham Meller in Turkey and was the son of a British diplomat. He grew up in Egypt, Mexico, Malawi, and Iran, influences which were later heard in The Clash's music. In remembering Strummer, British rocker and political activist Billy Bragg noted, "It was The Clash that struck a political stance that really inspired a lot of people." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau. We'll be right back.
While the Bush administration gathers its forces in the Persian Gulf to prosecute a war against Iraq, a growing crisis on the Korean Peninsula has attracted international concern and attention. North Korea's recent admission that it had maintained a covert nuclear weapons program in violation of a 1994 accord with the U.S., combined with open hostility from the White House, has escalated the crisis. North Korea's expulsion of U.N. weapons inspectors and the reopening of its plutonium-producing reactor in Yongbyon has provoked condemnation from the International Atomic Energy Agency, which warned that if Pyongyang does not change course, economic sanctions could be applied. South Korean President Kim Dae-jung won a Nobel Prize for initiating his sunshine policy toward North Korea. The effort to ease tensions and normalize relations between the Koreas was supported by the Clinton administration, which signed a 1994 accord with the North to supply fuel oil and two light water nuclear reactors in exchange for Pyongyang's pledge to halt development of nuclear weapons. But upon taking office, President Bush withdrew support for normalization and remained inconsistent in its willingness to talk with the communist North. Despite the crisis, South Korea's president-elect, Roh Moo-hyun, speaks for many of his citizens when he advocates a more moderate approach to the crisis than Washington. Growing hostility to the U.S. and South Korea stems from the perceived arrogance of a superpower and violence committed against civilians by some of the 37,000 U.S. servicemen stationed there. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Karen Lee of the Friends Committee on National Legislation, who examines the roots of the current crisis on the Korean Peninsula.
I think that North Korea looks at nuclear weapons the same way the U.S. claims to look at nuclear weapons. They're a deterrent. All they have to do is look at what's happening to Iraq and say, it's a really good idea for us to have nuclear weapons material. It makes our bargaining position much stronger. We've heard over and over again that the U.S. is not interested in invading, and I think it's good that we continue to develop our nuclear weapons. So I say in that way they have stuck with that strategy before the Bush administration. I think the irony here with the Bush administration is it came in and they said, we're not ready to talk. And then they said, okay, we're ready to talk, but only under these conditions. And then once North Korea said, yes, we're ready to talk, the Bush administration said, we're not ready to talk. And then we heard this October about the new nuclear program. The Bush administration said, we can't talk. They've been really consistent with not trying to talk to North Korea. They just don't want to talk to North Korea. They want North Korea to just go away. And there are people in Washington who are waiting for North Korea to collapse. They're still sticking to that scenario. If only North Korea would just collapse, then we don't have to worry about it anymore.
Why do you think North Korea has reacted the way it has? Do you think they're really steadfastly hoping to develop nuclear weapons, or is this, as many analysts feel, a bargaining chip that they hope to give back at some point in exchange for fuel aid, food aid, and other things they may desperately need?
Just to step back for a minute and remind ourselves that North Korea, as much as it appears to be a monolith, actually is not a monolith, and there's probably different people within the North Korean government working towards different ends. And I definitely think they're trying to get the Bush administration's attention. They know, as well as everybody else knows, that with conventional forces alone, they are a threat to South Korea. They are just over the border from Seoul, which is the capital and largest city in South Korea, and millions of people would die in any kind of military conflict. And South Korea doesn't want that, and the U.S. doesn't want that, and Japan and China don't want that either. So I think that they are trying to get more attention. And I think there are probably some people in the North Korean government who just want the nuclear weapons. But on a different tack, I want to say that, you know, North Korea has been suffering famine now probably for over 10 years, and there are still many people who until recently were receiving food from the UN agency, the World Food Program. They're receiving humanitarian assistance. That food aid has recently been cut off. But even though that food aid has stopped, other organizations, what are called non-governmental organizations or small humanitarian organizations, have continued to have their assistance programs with North Korea. So on the one hand, we have all this rhetoric between North Korea and the U.S. government. But on the other hand, you have ordinary U.S. citizens who are still going to North Korea, are still carrying out their medical relief programs, are still carrying out their agricultural rehabilitation programs. And those North Koreans are saying in a very profound way, we want to continue our relationship with the United States. We have trust in our U.S. partners. And to me, that's a very hopeful sign that this is just a bargaining chip and that these people in the agricultural ministry in the North Korean government are saying, okay, I'm going to let the political people and the foreign ministry people do whatever they want, but I know that for my country, I need to continue a relationship with people in the United States.
There's been growing hostility towards the United States and South Korea, some of it driven by the actions of a few of the 37,000 U.S. soldiers that are stationed there, the recent deaths of two young girls who were run over by a U.S. military vehicle. But maybe you can give us a quick summary of why this is going on, why so many South Koreans are demonstrating in the streets against the U.S. presence in their nation and U.S. policy.
There is some debate about how much we should see this as pure anti-Americanism in South Korea and how many of the people who are involved in these demonstrations are just saying, let's change the relationship with the U.S. We want U.S. troops to stay here, but we really have to change the relationship. The U.S. fought on the South Korea side, of course, during the Korean War, but it's never been an easy relationship. Before the war, there were many civilian deaths of which the U.S. was either aware or directly involved in. And then since the war, there's been ongoing everyday friction, such as cultural insensitivities, but there's also been much more serious crimes where there's U.S. troops, very often violence against women and violence against the women who serve the U.S. troops as prostitutes. So when two girls were run over this past summer, two teenage girls were walking to a birthday party and were run over by an armored vehicle. That case was tried in a military court, and the driver and navigator of the vehicle were exonerated. The Korean people have just had enough of that, and they're saying this kind of crime needs to be tried in our courts, and we need to be able to decide who's guilty. And it was that verdict that sparked off the current wave of demonstrations that rapidly grew until there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating all over the Korean Peninsula in weekly demonstrations, candlelight vigils. And one thing that's changed recently is that South Koreans, for the first time since the Korean War, have begun to see China as a closer ally than the United States. And that really transforms East Asia in a very significant way.
That was Karen Lee of the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Contact the committee by calling area code 202-547-6000 or visit their website at www.fcnl.org. Violence against women is an ongoing worldwide scourge and epidemic. The crime encompasses rape, sexual mutilation, the buying and selling of women and girls, and other forms of violence. UNIFEM, the United Nations Development Program for Women, hosted a program recently that presented stories illustrating how funds from UNIFEM have created programs to bring hope and healing to victims who have suffered unbearable violence. The event was held in conjunction with the 4th Annual International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women on November 25th. The theme of the program was Not a Minute More. Playwright, feminist, and anti-violence activist Eve Ensler opened the program by reading her essay called V-World, What It Looks Like When Violence Against Women Has Ended. We now present this essay, which was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus.
I currently reside in the land of violence. I have lived here all my life. I cannot even determine all the ways I have been shaped by this country and the ways of this country, as it is the only country or place I have ever known. Part of the problem of attempting to imagine another place, another way of being, another culture, is that the culture of violence is now so rooted, so deeply rooted in my cells, in my DNA. It has actually impacted my ability to imagine because violence has a deadly and distorting effect on the imagination. It creates hard, impenetrable walls where there should be doorways, and it creates despair where there could be great possibility. I say this as a person, as a woman, who has been shaped by violence from the moment of consciousness. As a daughter, whose father was an emotional terrorist who threatened my existence through his fist or hand or whip or voice or for most of the developing years of my life. I say this as a woman who did not stop tiptoeing around my own apartment until late into my 30s for fear of waking up the sleeping monster who might then beat me arbitrarily or lock me up. I say this as a woman who has lost the ability to say no early on in my life, and so for the first half of my life was a witness as my own body was taken many times against my deepest wishes. I say this as a woman who has struggled for most of my life not to lose my mind, not to self-destruct, as the violence has now become part of my own interior mental and spiritual landscape, working overtime against my own being. I say this as a woman who has witnessed the consequences of violence in every region of the world, in small villages and massive cities. Like poison trees, I see how women have grown with crooked trunks and missing limbs. So what is it that would allow for the possibility of imagining a world without violence, of conjuring the world, of being so grandiose, so naive, so ridiculous to think such a world could come to be? Maybe it's the sense of urgency and madness that pulses through everything, every muscle, every time the veil of denial lifts and one is confronted with the possibility of nerve gas, anthrax, mass rape, nuclear war, environmental collapse, or annihilation. Maybe it is the desire to break out of the familiar prison that violence has created, to actually confront my own fear of intimacy, of goodness, of love. Whatever it is, I believe that a world without violence is totally possible. I'm not talking about a world where there is no anger or passion or intensity or conflict or pain. I'm talking about a world where we refuse murder, rape, and brutality. I'm talking about putting down the guns, fists, knives, threats, loud voices, and weapons of mass destruction and living all of us in this wild vulnerability. I believe the world is possible because I have seen signs of it again and again in what has leaked through the violence, in what has miraculously and outrageously survived. How in spite of this poisoning, for example, women manage to keep producing edible fruits and holding up their branches. The world is a longing, and it is remembering. The world is what it smells like when they let you go, when you're not waiting to be hit, when you perspire from the sun instead of worry. The world is the 20-year-old girl suicide bomber who turned back. The world is the utter gentleness of the 30 comfort women between 70 and 90 who had been raped for 2 years, 12 hours a day by Japanese soldiers. It's the lives our mothers never got to live. The world is unfolding between your legs. It is urgent and slow. It's the joke the Palestinian woman told at a checkpoint that made the Israeli soldier laugh and accidentally lower the gun he had pointed in her face. It's the video camera the Afghan woman held under her burqa to document the execution of a woman in a stadium accused of flirting. The world is the place you could never touch in me, not with all the times you banged my head or whipped my legs. The world is the third way, not right, not wrong, sitting still, trusting tears. It's a state of mind. The world is the lipstick she wore during the shelling and the high heels she refused to take off even though the snipers were firing from above her city. The world is the weaving. The world is the empty breast she kept offering her baby who sucked and sucked knee-deep in mud. The world is the garden where the missing girls appear. Their mothers and fathers are waiting there. The world is the cut that didn't happen. It's the song they sang when they were refusing, birthing, planting. The world is after the pain has left and we sit in the utter emptiness. and we stop creeping around the hole but fall into it, and it's not what we thought. It's the opposite. B-World is the elephants and lions and eagles who grew back because we made space for them. It's the breath we finally took. It's the red dress we finally took off. B-World is borderless and groundless. There's nothing to defend, no beginning, no end.
That was playwright, feminist, and anti-violence activist Eve Ensler. For more information about Ms. Ensler's anti-violence work, visit her website at www.vday.org or contact UNIFEM at www.unifem.undp.org. On December 6th, 79-year-old peace activist Philip Berrigan died at Jonah House, a community he co-founded in 1973 with his wife Elizabeth McAllister, surrounded by family and friends 2 months after he was diagnosed with kidney and liver cancer. Philip Berrigan, who later became a Catholic priest, was drafted into World War II and began his 40-year struggle for peace in 1967 when he poured blood on draft files in Baltimore with three others. They came to be known as the Baltimore Four. He also led the Catonsville Nine, staging one of the most dramatic protests against the Vietnam War in 1968 by dousing homemade napalm on a small bonfire of draft records in a Catonsville parking lot. This action inspired a generation of anti-war dissent. Berrigan, the first priest to participate in a civil rights movement freedom ride in the early 60s, helped found the Plowshares movement in 1980. By attacking federal military property and anti-war and anti-nuclear protests, Berrigan would spend almost 11 years of his life in federal prisons. Philip's brothers, Jerome and Dan Berrigan, a Jesuit priest, also committed their lives to fight for peace and justice. Your reporter Denise Manzari spoke with Jerome Berrigan, who remembers Philip, who some called the prophet of peace.
We were all born in Minnesota. Phil was the youngest, then Dan, then myself. Jim and John still survive, and Thomas, the oldest of ourselves, died 8 years ago. I always attribute whatever we've been able to do in nonviolent defense of human rights to our mother's example. She was a German immigrant who came to this country at the age of 5, and her family were pioneers in northern Minnesota. They availed themselves of the Homestead Act, which meant that they occupied primitive land and built a log cabin and lived there for 5 years, at which time the property became theirs. Then she met my father. They were married there, and we were born there. Moved during the 20s to Syracuse, New York, and lived there during the Depression when so many people were out of work and walking the roads looking for a handout, for a meal, for something to eat. And no one was ever turned from our door. In fact, most commonly people were invited in and had a meal with us. Then when Dan and Phil were ordained as priests, they became involved in the civil rights movement. And Phil was a fellow marcher of Martin Luther King and was arrested. I think was the first Catholic priest to be arrested during that period of time. Then when King himself became aware of the deleterious effects of the Vietnam War on American society, and began to speak to that issue, Phil joined him there and went into a draft board with three other men in Baltimore and poured their own blood on draft files. Then came Catonsville in 1968 and the King of Prussia in 1969 and launched the Plowshares movement, which is still alert and viable and ongoing. So that pretty much brings us up to date.
In 1971, it was J. Edgar Hoover that actually named Philip as a co-conspirator.
Yes.
And the Harrisburg grand jury charged him with plotting to kidnap Henry Kissinger and blow up the utility tunnels of the U.S. Capitol buildings. However, Philip was only convicted of violating prison rules for smuggling out letters.
Right.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
The whole enterprise was a product of Hoover's paranoia. He was furious as a Catholic, as a nominal Catholic, I don't know whether he ever practiced, with the idea of two priests, like the Berrigan brothers, defying federal law and spending time in prison. And he presented himself as scandalized and furious, as I said, and pushed the investigation where there was actually nothing to investigate. It was all spurious and made up, so that finally charges were dropped.
What, Jerome Berrigan, is your feeling about the peace movement now, the strength of it, where it will be going in the future?
From all I can discover and read about, the peace movement is a sleeping giant which is slowly awakening and is getting not the press it deserves, not the exposure it deserves. Many, many friends that I have are committed to committing civil disobedience if and when the attack on Iraq begins. People generally are becoming more aware that the attack on Iraq will result in innocent deaths, men, women, and children, and will accomplish nothing. I consider that those who are validly in defense of and in love with the reality of the United States today are those who are opposing war and are true patriots, whether or not they fly the American flag. You know, I believe that war is outmoded as a instrument of national policy. It does simply one thing, and that is lead to more war and more killing and more deaths. And those who sponsor it and cause it and propose it are into their own agenda, and they are not patriotic at all. So there you are, for what it's worth.
That was Jerome Berrigan. For more information on the Plowshares movement, visit the website www.plowsharesactions.org. Donations can be sent to Jonah House, 1301 Moreland Avenue, Baltimore, Maryland, 21216. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Rita Brundage, Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Chuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.